Hello, everybody, and welcome into another episode of the Comics Experience Make Comics podcast, the show where we talk about nuts and bolts of making comics. And today, Andy Schmidt and I are joined by Fred Van Lente. Fred, as you will know his work from the Marvel Universe, the Valiant Universe, G.I. Joe's Battlefields, Conan, currently on Riverdale, or Archie, sorry, not Riverdale, everything's Archie, reading and looking at the cover at the same time, which I should not do. And today we're going to be talking about writing for a shared universe, which is an upcoming comics experience course that happens on July 12th and runs through August that you can take with Fred for 6 weeks. It's a standard kind of comics experience course in the way that it's set up, where you get 2 hours with Fred each session. You have work that you do on your own and then bring it to class. And it's a lot of great back and forth. So, Fred, thanks for making time to do this, number one. But number two, curious, and we talked about this before we started rolling, about your first experience doing anything related to doing a shared universe.
I tell the story a lot, but I was reminded of it recently for a very specific and kind of good reason. But, you know, the very first time I got to write for Marvel Comics, they had done a poll on their website. The fans voted on a character, a Marvel character that was going to get sort of reinvented. And the Scorpion, the Spider-Man villain, won. And the assignment I got from the editors was that she was going to be a teenage female S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, this new Scorpion. And so I sent them a pitch, because I was trying to integrate it into the Marvel Universe, you know. So these two villains, Viper and Silver Samurai, they're always hanging out together. And so my pitch was basically they got drunk in Madripoor one night, and this character, the Scorpion, came out. and my pitch ended up was rejected, although my editor really liked it, and he said, you know, we'll work in together, but we're going to go with another pitch. That writer ended up being fired off the project, and they called me up, and they were like, you know, we need a script in a week. And they're like, we love your pitch, go for it, except that Silver Samurai and Viper are over in Wolverine, and you can't use them. So And that was my whole pitch, was that she was the daughter of these two characters, and basically I was left with nothing. So, but they let me use advanced idea mechanics, and so I came up with this character, Monica Rappaccini, who was Scientist Supreme of AIM and was Carmilla the Scorpion's mother. And this is my very first Marvel comic, and so, you know, talk about being in a shared universe. So when Patton Oswalt's MODOK show premiered on Hulu, I was very, it's great because in the second episode, Monica Rappaccini turns out to be a major character in the show. In one episode, they go to where she goes to school, and it's time travel thing. So they visit her as a child, MODOK and his wife. Yes, MODOK and his wife. It's a great show, by the way. I'm super biased, but it was very cool to see Carmilla and Monica animated. But when they go to Monica's elementary school, as I said, this is a time travel episode. It is Van Lente Elementary. And so I have a building named after me in the MCU. So my ability to think quickly on my feet while working in a shared universe has gotten me both money and a strange sort of fame, at least on Hulu.
That's great.
That is pretty awesome to have a building named after you in a fictional universe.
It is.
Not many people can say that. Streets, sure. Every has a street named after
them. That's right. There's always the corner of Finger and Kane in the animated series. But MODOK goes to Kirby University, and Monica goes to Van Lente Elementary, and I think that that properly reflects the differences between me and Jack Kirby's contribution to comics. And a big shout out to Wendy McClendon Covey, who plays Monica, and she's terrific.
That is terrific. I have not made it to episode two, by the way. Just now I have something to look forward to. I watched episode one last week, so I've got no excuse now.
Did you start writing when you were getting into writing in general? Because you write more than comics, too. So, like,
right.
Were there, you know, growing up as a fan of something, were you like man, I really need to write a Gem in the Holograms comic, or
right.
What was the one or, you know, a handful maybe that you really wanted to write? And then did you get to write them, and was it fun?
Yeah. I mean, I was a total Marvel zombie. I was a total Marvel stan. Like I memorized the official handbook to the Marvel Universe, which came out when I was a kid in the 80s for the first time. And I had all these different like series I was going to do. Like I really wanted to do a series with the Rangers, who were like the Texas superheroes that were introduced in Hulk. One of the first comics I remember buying. Red Wolf, Firebirds, Shooting Star, Texas Twister, and Knight Rider, the renamed Ghost Rider, since they already had a Ghost Rider. That was the first Ghost Rider. It was the one on the horse, right, before it was a motorcycle.
That's how you knew he was in Texas.
I had never had Contest of Champions, but I made up a whole superhero team of the, like, made-up, like, Peregrine and Shamrock and, like, the made-up superheroes from the different countries for Contest of Champions. And
nice.
They were on a team. I forget what they were called. And I would just sit there and shoot baskets. I would shoot basketball in my driveway. My mother thought it was a little strange. Ultimately, I thought it was a little strange. And just come up with these stories in my head. And so it took me, you know, I think about, well, funnily enough, the very first job, and technically it was for Marvel, but I got a job. Well, what happened was is I went to college and I became friends with a bunch of guys studying illustration, one of whom I still work with today, Ryan Dunleavy. Another guy I befriended was Steve Ellis, and he and I started doing comics together, and I really loved writing. I went to school for screenwriting, and I sort of was into writing novels also, but really it was working with actual comic artists that sort of solidified comics writing as the thing for me. And the very first job, and Steve and I actually ended up pitching something and having it accepted by Malibu, which at the time had just been bought by Marvel. And Malibu actually gave me my first comic, which was Prime. For those of you unfamiliar with the Ultraverse, Prime was essentially a sort of more science-based Shazam, like Captain Marvel. He was this kid who sort of grew this, like, it was almost like a Rick and Morty concept. Like, he just grew this flesh suit of an adult superhero over himself, which was sort of gooey and weird the more you think about it. I think Norm Brayfogle drew it. Interesting character, but I found out, like, you know, I submitted this script for this fill-in issue of Prime. This is back when there were fill-in issues in the 90s. Kids, fill-in issues are what we used to call or inventory issues, or single done-in-one stories that you would keep on file in case the regular team was running late and you absolutely had to get a book out. You would just, you know, drop that inventory story in. Now the book is just late. Or they just add, you know, the editors just add 17 more artists on it, and you know, the colorist has to kill himself because they hold the pages
all
on
of those,
Friday.
All of those solutions are wonderful.
That's right. They're a lot of fun. Well, it used to be, you know, the inventory books are how you broke in. You know, that's definitely how I broke in. I mean, I call it breaking in, but my first, you know, comic, mainstream comic, came out in 1997, and then I think then the one that Scorpion and Monica appear in, that was 2005, so it was almost 8 years later. Anyway, so again, working within a shared universe, you know, this is a lot of stuff we'll be dealing with in class, is because this kid, Prime's alter ego, grew this sort of flesh suit around him, a big story point in my script was that Prime gets knocked unconscious, and the editors were like, you can't do that. Prime can't be knocked unconscious. And I was like, what? Isn't that a major part of a superhero's job description? Is taking hits to the face and being knocked unconscious? But no, apparently if Prime falls unconscious, the skin suit just dissolves. So I had to figure out, I can't remember how I solved that problem, but I had to like figure out a way to not do my story without knocking Prime unconscious, which I did.
Yeah. So I like the Scorpion and Monica thing. I, as an editor, I remember giving notes like, yeah, okay, this is great, but you can't use any of the elements in it, but we'd still like you to do the story.
That's like, right. Yeah, and I mean,
always that... something, and there's, you know, and the, I think there's the, I think one of the key things that you hit on for me about, you know, if you're working in a shared universe with any kind of regularity, you're just constantly being thrown curveballs.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite example is I was editing X Factor at the time, but I was, I technically as an editor, I was in the Marvel Heroes office. So I was working on Fantastic Four and the Avengers. I just happened to be the X Factor editor for reasons, but all of the other X-Men titles, all of the other ones were in the X office for obvious reasons. So, you know, and I was friends with those guys and we would chat, but, you know, I'd been doing X Factor for a while now. And then, and so like, it just didn't occur to us to like, sort of be, you know, like if I had a guest character or something, I didn't usually run it by them because it wasn't usually a big deal or whatever. Well, in one of the X-Men series, I forget which one it was now. And I didn't know that this was happening until the week it came out and I read it in the printed comic on store shelves. But Banshee was killed, and Banshee was the father of Siren, one of my main characters in X Factor.
Right.
And so, you know, but that also meant, because we were working like 3 months ahead, that also meant that Siren would have no reaction whatsoever to her father dying.
Right.
For a minimum of 3 or 4 months. Like for readers, we're going to keep reading X Factor and be like, why isn't she talking about, you know, Banshee? That was a big deal. Banshee just died. But because of that circumstance where we weren't going to be able to address it for a while, I called up Peter, the writer, and we talked about it. And then he hit on the idea that we went with, which was that she was in denial of her father dying. And, you know, and because we're in the Marvel universe where people come back from the dead all the time, you right. know, she was just kind of like, he'll be back. It's fine. Like, it seems bad, but he'll get better. You know, and that was like her take on it. And everybody else kind of reacted around her like, no, he's dead. Like, that's like, you should deal with that. So it wound up creating this whole like different sort of, I don't know that I'd say character arc, but this whole facet to her character and how she related to all these other characters that never would have happened had we actually not been working in a shared universe where all of a sudden we had to deal with this thing and had to deal with it in a specific way. So there's, as much as you're sometimes thrown curveballs where you're like, I don't get to do what I want to do, sometimes you're thrown a curveball and you're like, you get something you never would have gotten
otherwise. Right. Out of it. Well, yeah. I mean, I, you know, returning to the MODOK thing, I mean, I wouldn't have a name. I wouldn't have a building named after the MCU if they didn't let me, you know, they took away Vibrant Silver Samurai. So it's like necessity is the mother of invention. You know, the second series I did, so Steve Ellis and I, we ended up, I guess I can say this because those Malibu characters never come back. So we sort of like, we ended up doing the series we sold to Malibu as an independent comic called The Silencers. And that's sort of why I got hired. That's why Marvel reached out to me to do The Scorpion in the first place. And so I was like, okay, well, The Silencers is set on the fringes of a superhero universe about criminals, about superpowered mobsters. So I thought, why don't I try and revive, because Marvel liked The Silencers, I'll try and revive Supervillain Team-Up, which was this old title from the 70s.
Yeah, 70s.
Yeah, Doctor Doom and Submariner primarily. So I sent Marvel a list of like Sabretooth and Magneto and Doc, just as a list of villains I wanted to put in Supervillain Team Up. And they were just like, no. MODOK. Okay, you can use MODOK. The last one on the list. And so I was like, what the heck, man? So I decided to lean into it. And rather than have it be kind of a semi-serious look at super criminals and world beaters, it became a bunch of loser superheroes performing this insane heist. And that became MODOK 11. And I grabbed all these characters no one cared about, like Puma and Deadly Nightshade and The Spot, you know. And Monica, again, was the villain in that. And ironically, and this is, again, you know, problem using shared universe, is that the fourth episode of Hulu's MODOK series is sort of a riff on MODOK 11. except that on their end, Patton Oswalt actually wrote that episode. On their end, they couldn't actually use any of the characters from Mod X 11 because they were all Spider-Man characters. And as many of you on this call know, Sony has the TV and movie rights to them. So you know, the shared universe giveth and the shared universe taketh away for various reasons. Although some of the things that Oswald, like Oswald put Angar the Screamer in there. And now when I was watching the show, I was kicking myself that it didn't occur to me to use Angar the Screamer because, you know, he was an A. So he was always in that first issue of the Marvel Handbook. So that was definitely one of the characters I was thinking about shooting hoops, you know, in the 80s when I was a child. So I was like, oh, Angar the Screamer. Why didn't I use Angar the Screamer?
So have you got any, I mean, obviously you were a Marvel fan. Have you gotten a chance to write, I mean, you've been in obviously other shared universes, but did you have any other kind of, you know, golden goose ones that you have or have not had a chance to write yet?
I mean, I've only done one. It would be fun to do something for DC. It'd be particularly fun to do something in sort of the Mr. Miracle, Orion, New Gods, the whole sort of Kirby verse. And we had been talking about, it's just one of those things that it's just never clicked. Never really been able to get off the ground, that kind of stuff. So that would be fun. That would be a fun. Although, so I've done exactly one DC comic, a 6-page holiday story I did with Nick Dragotta for Martian Manhunter, which was fun. But you know, I sort of get more interested in, like, you know, I like it when people come to me with things because things I've never, you know, occurred to me to do. Like G.I. Joe was sort of an interesting challenge when John Barber at IDW asked me to do that. But again, that was a challenge because, number one, no one told me when I took on G.I. Joe that Larry Hama was also doing. I guess I could have figured that out on my own, but I did not realize that Larry Hama was doing his own G.I. Joe series and would continue to do a G.I. Joe series next that had separate continuity. Which I believe was continuing from the Marvel comic continuity.
Oh, it was. I was the editor that relaunched that.
Yeah, and I mean...
150 and a half.
Yeah, I mean, you know, competing with Larry Hama in G.I. Joe is like competing with Jesus at a Jesus convention. Like, I really felt like I was under the gun. And, you know, again, they wouldn't let me use Scarlet because Scarlet had her own book and had her own special ops team, and they wouldn't let me use... And they'd killed off Snake Eyes, so... I was sort of robbed of two of the most important Joes, so that was a bit of a challenge. But
yeah, that's now you're fighting Larry Hama.
I know, right? And Larry Hama gets to use Snake Eyes and Scarlet, you know. Right. So, yeah, but yeah, you know, this is part of the challenge is that you always have to basically fight with you usually have to fight with one arm tied behind your back because you never get. It's always this sort of, you know, monkey's paw situation of you get what you wish for, but with a twist, you know.
I have a question for both of you, because you've been in different positions on the Summit side, and that's something that is mentioned about this upcoming Comics Experience class with you, Fred, is you're essentially going to have a writer summit. From,
yes.
I guess, both of your perspectives, is there anything that, you know, going into it for the first time or even now that you think about? You know, I imagine there's pitching involved to a point, but is it the same as it's not the same as regular pitching? Is there anything that kind of stands out to you there as a contrast to normally how you might approach taking an idea to an editor or taking an idea to a publisher?
Well, I mean, you know, the writer's summit is sort of different than a writer's room in a TV show. I guess the one situation I had like that was when we were doing the Webheads with Amazing Spider-Man, which, by the way, was absolutely my number one bucket list book. So when I got to do that, that was pretty exciting. Where there weren't necessarily assigned. So like if you go to a Marvel summit, and we did this at Valiant also, we did Valiant summits, and I think we sort of did a very limited one for G.I. Joe because of the various books. You sort of go as a representative of your book, and when you sort of work on the shared storylines, everyone's like the Iron Man writer is trying to figure out how Iron Man works into this, and the Hulk writer is trying to figure this out. And while the editors in chief and the head honchos have kind of a larger, you know, overview, the
the writers all kind of are both bouncing ideas off of each other while the same kind of protecting their turf, you know, is probably the most polite way I can think of putting it. Now, in the class, we're going to simulate that. It won't be quite the same thing, for one thing, because I hope some of those larger summits can be a little cutthroat. I don't want to necessarily do that in a, I don't think that's useful in a class setting, but it'll be much more collaborative and easygoing. And I would like to think of myself as a leader, and the teacher is a bit more easygoing than some of the people who led those Marvel summits. You know, it's still a very similar environment, where you sort of have to learn, pitching in the room, and you basically have to learn yourself to be as equal as possible in the best case scenario. And where if you pitch out an idea that get shot down, you know, don't throw a temper tantrum, you know, and try to be respectful of others' ideas. You know, it's a creative people aren't always the most socially adept people, but that's sort of the kind of simulations. But it's part of the reason I'm so excited when Andy and I sort of started talking about this class and doing it, is that sort of take that as, I almost feel like, you know, as great as some of the other courses I've taught, this is in many ways as close as you're going to get to actually working for a comic book publisher is in this class, because anytime you have a shared group of books, and ironically, you know, thanks to the huge success of the MCU, everybody's trying to do shared universes, you know, Universal's trying with the monsters, they're trying to do with Mortal Kombat, you know, Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, you know, is trying to be a franchise, trying to be a multi-platform franchise. So these are very important skills that you need to become a successful working creative person in any storytelling field.
Yeah, I will say that it was true a little bit before the MCU, but certainly since the MCU exploded, like, I get a lot more consulting work because of my ability to work in shared universes.
Right. Because you did Transformers as well, obviously, and a bunch of those Hasbro properties, right?
Yeah. I've worked on a ton of shared universes now, and in some form or another. But it's interesting because sometimes, you know, somebody in, usually it's, you know, somebody like in the LA area will say, you know, we'll tell me their plan for a shared universe, what they want to do, and they want me to consult on how to do it. And it usually goes kind of one of three ways. One, they already have a plan, and then they want me to tell them that their plan is a great one and will absolutely succeed, when usually I look at the plan and I'm like, yeah, this is not going to work out real well. And I have my reasons for that, but usually what it comes down to is their plan is, we're going to build a universe. not we're going to tell really great stories that happen to be in the universe, but
right.
But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of interesting because everybody's looking for that. So, you know, almost overnight, my resume started getting picked up and passed around, and I've been doing work out there for a long time, and hopefully it's helpful to people, and, you know,
yeah.
But it is fascinating that that's become a thing, when, like, growing up, like, that, like, trying to explain that to people was hard. Like, oh yeah, you know, Spider-Man can meet the Fantastic Four and the X-Men, and people were like, what, really? Like, it was kind of a novel idea.
Yeah, I mean, with The Silencers, this book I mentioned that was, you know, got me the Marvel attention in the early aughts, it got picked up for movies, and I got sent the treatment from the screenwriter, and, like, it was just sort of amazing to me, because the premise of The Silencers is that there is already a superhero universe, and this is just, we're just not paying any attention to the heroes. It's a book about the villains. But for some reason, the movie makers had to make it a story point in the movie to explain why people have superpowers. And, like, the main character of our book, and who's the main character of the movie, obviously, gets these, like, it's like experimented on by the government, like all the stuff that, who gives a crap with the origin? Anyway, we didn't bother with the origins. They're superheroes and supervillains, deal with it. You know, this is not a,
but to even to Hollywood, even 20, you know, let's call it, I think it was like 17 years ago, they were like, no, this is superpowers. What? That's weird. And now in the Disney Plus shows, they didn't even bother recapping it. They just assume you've seen all the other movies, you know, and they're just like, you know, deal with it. There's all these famous superhero characters running around, and we don't even have to bother telling you, you know, who they are, or where they come from. And that is, you know, really a sort of a demonstration of how far the genre, at least of superheroes specifically, have come. You know, people still complain that the continuity of superhero comics is too complicated. And I just don't agree with that at all. You know, if you read any manga, like try picking up, you know, volume 25 of One Piece. Like, they don't even bother explaining to you what's going on. You just kind of have to figure it out, and you're expected to have read volumes 1 through 24. You know, the challenge isn't the continuity of the shared universe. The challenge is that, you know, every mainstream superhero comic gets rebooted every year, and so you have no idea which number one is the one you start at. At least Berserk, you know, starts at volume 1 and goes to volume whatever, you know?
Yeah, that has been an issue for me. Like, you know, when I was at Marvel, the prevailing theory was, you know, you didn't talk about continuity, but you tried to make sure the characters were consistent, which that was fine. But once the number ones kept coming, like a new number one in a series every year or two, like I was working there and I got lost. Like, I mean, yeah. I remember like somebody be like, yeah, it was in Captain America, like issue 3, and I'm like, which Captain America issue 3 are we talking about? You know, at least with a mini series, there was like a subtitle to it,
right?
You know, whatever. But then they get collected, and it's like Captain America by so and so, volume 1, volume 2, volume 3,
right?
And
sometimes that's the only way you can tell them apart is the creative teams, you know?
Yeah, but it created a challenge, because, you know, after I left Marvel, like I'd been reading tons and tons of Marvel comics for years and just absorbing like way too much of it. And I really needed just like a mental break. It wasn't like any kind of like, you know, scoffing. I just needed a break from superheroes for a while.
Right.
And I tried to come back. I mean, it was several years later, but that meant that cycle had kept going with all these new number ones. And like, I legitimately could not figure out how to get back into it.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know where to start
again. I mean, the problem is that it's sort of the marketplace, you know, the American comics, you know, kind of go after that short term monthly retail dollar. And that sort of requires them to do this constant rebooting and getting that, you know, if anything, you wish that some of these characters would just kind of go away. Like there was that period in the mid aughts when Thor wasn't anywhere, you know, and then he got Brad with what was it, J. Michael Straczynski wrote that book when Thor returned. And that was like a really big deal. Like you wish that they would have the ability to kind of make the characters go away a little bit, you know, and kind of figure out a way to maybe not glut the market with all these reboots, because obviously A, there's diminishing returns on sales, and B, it just, the barrier to entry becomes very high. You know, I mean, yeah. At least with the movies, that's sort of another advantage the movies have, is that, you know, you're only going to get an Ant-Man and the Wasp movie every couple years, you know, so, and it's always the same people playing Ant-Man and the Wasp, at least Marvel's changed casting on some people, but I guess the Hulk was the most major recast. But, and so there's that continuity there. But again, you know, dealing with these kinds of, curveballs is something the class is going to be about, and this won't be a problem in the class, obviously, because we're going to be creating a whole new universe.
Yeah, which by the way, we didn't talk about this at all, and I mean, we've taken up a lot of your time already, Fred, so I appreciate that. But you know, the creating a universe is significantly different than operating in one that already exists. And so, one of the things that when we were talking about what you're going to do for the class, one of the things that really piqued my interest and I think would be great is that you get that aspect of creation and world building as, you know, as well as the the sense of, what'd you put it, like, you know, as close as we can simulate of, you know, right, the real working environment. So you kind of get, you're even getting more, right? Because you also get to figure
right
out how some of these things, how the world, how the shared universe works.
Well, really, you know, the class is going to be structured sort of in two halves. In the very first day, I'm going to want people to, and if you're thinking about signing up for the class, listeners, this will pique your interest a little bit. I want everybody to come in with a character from a pre-existing shared universe that they want to write. And that'll be the basis for the first writing assignment. I don't care if it's Wolverine or Batman or Scarlet or My Little Pony, you know, anything, pre-existing character, and this will be your chance to kind of write. If you have a Spider-Man story you've been dying to tell, you know, keeping in mind, of course, we don't own these characters and you don't either. This is all, you know, in an academic learning environment. Bring it in, and you know, who knows? Maybe I will throw you a curveball once you show up with those characters, or maybe I won't. Maybe I'm just messing with your head.
I'm gonna work on my
editors never like to mess with writers' heads.
Gonna work on my Count Chocula pitch. I think
there you go.
Shared
right
serial monster universe.
That's right. He's secretly Boo Berry's long lost brother.
what did they do to Fruit Brute?
Crisis on Infinite Bowls.
Oh boy, I'm gonna cut this part out and make this my pitch.
That's right. This is gold, baby. General Mills, if you're listening.
Andy, is there anything else folks should know about the upcoming course?
Well, they should know that now would be a good time to start signing up for it, because I do expect slots to go fairly quickly on this one, because Fred doesn't teach classes all that often, and he also doesn't tend to repeat them. So this is it, and it is online now at comicsexperience.com, and you can just click on the courses. And it's called Writing for a Shared Universe. It's very cleverly titled, but yeah, I mean, it sounds great. Like, it sounds really, really fun to me. I would enjoy taking it if I weren't super busy doing a few other things.
I think we have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be fun, and like a huge amount of learning too. Like, I really do think the way that you've designed this, Fred, is really ripe for some great, very pragmatic writing lessons. So yeah, that's all I got.
And I'm excited because the students will be interacting with each other a lot more than the usual. It's be much more of a workshop atmosphere as opposed to, you know, me talking and other people listening or anything like that. It's much more sort of hands-on experience.
Yeah.
And that kicks off July 12th. Andy, any other Comics Experience news? I know last episode you talked about Comics Experience Publishing, which is fairly substantial news.
Yeah, a little bit. So Stud and the Blood Blade number one should hit shelves at the end of July. So please make sure your retailers know that you want it. The initial order has already come and gone, but they can always place a reorder, and hopefully Diamond is getting enough to restock those. But please, you know, support new creators. Perry and Jed are awesome that are creating Stud and the Blood Blade, and you know, they could really use your support. And by far the bulk of the profits go to the creators, not to Comic Experience Publishing. So you really are supporting, like in some other places, you really are supporting the creators when you're supporting these books. So please, please, please go do that.
And Fred, right now, Everything's Archie is coming out. And also, it feel like I buried the lead on the Dynamite. I looked at that the other day. That seems like an interesting crossover.
Yeah. No one can say I'm not eclectic. Today dropped, as we're recording this on a Wednesday, Everything's Archie, which is sort of this one-shot 80th anniversary of Archie celebration I did with Dan Parent, current Archie art god. And Dynamite Lives, which is the sequel to last year's runaway hit, Dynamite. That's Die! !Numite, which is the Dynamite Comics crossover. Ash Williams from Army of Darkness joins Vampirella, zombie/evil Red Sonja, and zombie Peter Cannon, zombie Thunderbolt, and all of your other Dynamite Comics friends to fight and or become zombies.
Come on, that just sounds like too much fun.
It's been a blast, and particularly working with Ash Williams is so much fun to write. And again, talk about shared universes. That's several shared universes mashed together into one.
That's awesome.
Yeah, not just anybody can tackle that. That takes a special kind of insanity to try and tackle that project. I applaud you, sir.
It's been a ton of fun.
Do you find, is it something, it might be too in the weeds. How long does it take you to kind of get a take on that with something that is, it is eclectic and interesting.
Yeah. What I tend to do is I tend to try and seek out the first appearance of characters. Like for Red Sonja, I just went back and got on Comixology her first appearance in Conan the Barbarian. They got me. I read a lot of those original Charlton 60s Peter Cannon Thunderbolt comics, which are bananas. Pantha, who is this Vampirella Warren character, appears. So I got a bunch of Pantha comics. I just read old comics, which, let's be honest, I'd probably be doing for free anyway. So it's now they're tax deductible. You know,
that should also be on the Comics Experience listing for this. Also, it could be tax deductible.
That's right. Writing and IRS tips.
You can't afford to not take it.
You literally can't afford not to take
it. I've also, Comic Book History of Animation, I am waiting to tear into. It is on my bedstand.
The
comic book history books that you do along with at the Action series, Action Philosophers, Action Presidents. If you're looking for more Fred Van Lente work and you haven't checked those out, they're great.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and regular bookstore buyers can get it from IDW Comic Book History of Animation next month.
Oh, fantastic.
The soft cover. Kickstarter backers got the fancy hardcover.
And it is a really nice hardcover.
Yeah, Ryan did a great job on that one. Ryan, so, one of the people I met in college, I'm still working with.
And your best place to find you online?
If you can spell my name, you can find me on Twitter. That's fredvanlente.com. Fred Van Lente on Facebook. The Fred Van Lente Elementary School sadly does not exist. Only on Hulu.
Go to Hulu and watch MODOK, which is
watch Marvel's MODOK, which is genuinely fantastic. It's so wonderful to be able to enthusiastically plug something that's been so kind to you.
and it's very fun. And I think as a longtime Marvel reader, you know, there's a bunch in there for people like us that grew up reading comics, but it's so accessible. You don't need to know anything other than it's MODOK and he's got kind of a dual life going and it kind of
stop motion is terrific. The animation is terrific. The voice casting is great. It's just really well done.
It's really great. I laughed a lot and it was really impressed. And now I'm looking forward to seeing Angar and how that plays out. Well, if you have questions you want to hear talked about on the show, email info@comicsexperience.com. Andy, you're on Twitter. I know your miniseries with DC is winding down, so folks can still get on that train.
Yeah, issue four is on stands now. So we've got two issues left, but I just saw a bunch of reviews of issue four where and reviews on issues 1 through 3 were quite positive and kind. But it seems like issue four, people really surprised folks, and so it seems like it turned up the heat on it. So people are really
spicy.
Seem really excited now. I think that's because we did the first three issues were kind of, I wouldn't call them quite standard, but they're an origin story where you kind of know what to expect. But issues 4, 5, and 6 are, still part of their overall origin, but it kind of kicks off a new arc in a different direction. So I think people really didn't expect where it started to head now, which was nice. And actually, the plan all along was we wanted you to get in knowing what you were getting into, but then pull the rug out from under you, hopefully in a good way a little bit, so that it leaves an impression.
Excellent. Well, if you have a question, like I said, email info@comicsexperience.com. You can tweet Comics Experience is on Twitter @ComicExperience and also on Instagram as Comics Experience. And until next time, keep making comics.